words today with David Helvarg, founder and president of the Blue Frontier Campaign, author of three books, including Blue Frontier, editor of Ocean and Coastal Conservation Guide, award-winning journalist, war correspondent in North Ireland and Central America. He's produced over 40 broadcast documentaries for PBS, Discovery, and others. He's also a licensed private investigator in his spare time and also surfs and scuba dives while living in Washington, D.C. You're a busy guy. Good morning, and welcome to our program.
Morning. Thank you. It's nice to be back on a coast with a nice river leading to a nicer ocean.
Is that saying you don't spend much time swimming in the Potomac?
You know, trying to save the seas from a concrete-covered swamp has its limitations, and I think I'm going to start migrating back to the left coast.
Well, we'll welcome you with open arms here. And want to talk to you today about your two books. The one, Blue Frontier, which is actually a reprint and an expansion, I understand, was its third printing?
Yeah, and about one-third new materials. It's in the 5 years since the first edition came out, a lot has happened, not all for the good. But
I was going to say, not all of it's good news by any means. And then you have a second new piece out called 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, which sort of is a nice accompaniment, I suppose, to get people not to be too much in a funk.
Well, it's a nice book, and you know, it's illustrated by my friend Jim Toomey, who does the Sherman Lagoons comic strip. It's, I don't know if it's in the Oregonian, but it's in about 200 papers. Philippe Cousteau, the grandson, wrote the intro. And, you know, it's both the frustration and the hope is that we know what the solutions are. It's it's getting people engaged and understanding that they can make a difference.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Oregonian's kind of a Mary Worth type of comic page most of the time, so they frequently pull controversial strips. But I have seen that his work in other publications quite good. Well, let's talk a little bit about Blue Frontier. When you first came out, it obviously had some very disturbing information about what was happening, and also the fact that, you know, Homo sapiens just don't know that much about what goes on out there in the deep blue sea. Have things gotten better or worse in 3 years from its first publication?
Well, it's there's some signs of hope, but overall the situation continues to deteriorate. Really, it's this cascading series of disasters our living oceans faced. We launched the books on Earth Day this year, and of course, even that's a misnomer. It's not really planet Earth, it's planet ocean. You know, you talk about God greens Earth, but you get out in space, there's this deep blue marble, 71% of the surface and 95% of the living space. But unfortunately, many people, even environmentalists, kind of think the environment ends at the shore's edge. And as a result, there's been this ecological meltdown that's gone largely unnoticed until recent years. The industrial overfishing taking place for the global seafood market, the coastal pollution of nearshore oceans. The UN identifies over 46 dead zones around the world, a third of them here in the U.S., plus the growth of harmful algal blooms and other disturbances related to industrial and agricultural runoff. Coastal sprawl, which is, we talk about the land boom of the 19th century, it's nothing compared to what's happened along our marine coast in the last 40 years. And we're taking out the salt marshes and the estuaries and the seagrass meadows and the mangrove swamps that are the filters and nurseries of the sea, the areas we most need for restoration. And on top of all this, you have fossil fuel-fired climate disruption, which we've seen the effects of not acting. I was down in the Gulf after Katrina, and you sort of, it's like the old Irish saying about the potato famine. God brought the blight, but the British brought the famine. You know, natural disasters being turned into human catastrophes by our failure to respond to issues around wetlands and coastal development and climate change. And climate is also, it's not only warming oceans and raising sea levels, it's bleaching corals. I've seen this from Florida to Fiji to Australia. Warming waters, essentially, top scientists I've talked to say half the world's tropical reefs are essentially dead. They're going to die as a result of the warming we've already put into the system. Acidification of the ocean, the slowing of the conveyor belt that drives the Gulf Stream, which could put New England and Western Europe into a new ice age. That's why I don't call it global warming anymore. It's much more about a complete climactic shift. And, of course, the oceans are the drivers of climate and weather, but we've been ignoring the impacts here, and they're tremendous. It's almost depressing, except for the fact that, and when I first wrote Blue Frontier, the end of it, you you know, I visited aircraft carriers and oil rigs and underwater labs and talked to all these people. And at the end, I didn't have the urge to go into the ocean and just drown myself. And the reason I didn't is just all these fantastic watermen and waterwomen I've met all around the U.S. who are working at a local level. It's what I call the seaweed rebellion, marine grassroots, and have solutions. And you see practical solutions and success stories all around. But the question's, you know, how do we scale it up from local to regional, national and global? And, you know, I think the answer is we have to do it from the bottom up. I think that there have been two major U.S. ocean commissions reported in the last 4 years, the Independent Pew Ocean Commission, the Bush-appointed U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy. They both came out with very different makeups, but they came out with very similar conclusions that the ecological collapse of U.S. oceans are a threat to our national security, our economy, and, of course, our environment. And they produced between them over 300 recommendations. Now, unfortunately, a few weeks ago, the chairs, Leon Panetta, who chaired the Pew Commission, lifelong Democrat, chief of staff under the Clinton administration, Admiral Jim Watkins, who was Secretary of Energy under Bush 1, and before that, chief of naval operations, a lifelong Republican, came to Washington, and they gave a report card to the White House and Congress how they'd responded to the recommendations. They gave them a D+, and personally, I think they were grading on a curve. I mean, there's a failure at the top, and yet most people don't realize that it's all public domain, that, you know, in 1890, the Census Bureau declared the frontier closed, the western frontier. In 1983, Ronald Reagan declared an exclusive economic zone that stretches 200 miles from the coasts, and it's 3.4 million square nautical miles. It's 30% larger than our land base. And it's all ours. It's public domain, and we have to, you know, in a last true wilderness range. But, you know, even as we're discovering new species every day off in the deep waters off Oregon, the Monterey Canyon of California and elsewhere, even as we're discovering new life, we're putting it at risk by our practices.
There's some of that same frontier attitude still going on in terms of exploitation of the resources. And again, I was, one of the things that keeps reminding me when I read the book is, you know, we continue to operate this way despite big black holes in our knowledge base about how the oceans are operating. I mean, we're just now getting a better idea of the thermal engine and how that, you know, the currents are affecting things. But, you know, people are still startled at finding these layers in the ocean where nothing seems to be happening, where they think there should be stuff happening, and what have you.
It's amazing. The last 25 years, we've probably learned more than the previous 25,000. You know, until 1977, we thought all life in the universe was photosynthetic, came from solar power. And then there was this people looking at volcanic activity 8,000 feet down off the Galapagos. And they called up to Alvin's mothership, the Atlantis. They said, we got any biologists up there? Because they'd found all these sea worms with red feathers and big white clams and crabs that all contained bacteria that they could convert this hot hydrogen sulfide that was bubbling up from the Earth's core and under tremendous pressure convert it to energy for life. And now we know there's chemosynthetic life in the universe. And we think if there's any life in our solar system, we'll find it under the icy surface of Jupiter, Moon, Europa, because we think there's an ocean below there, a water ocean, and there's volcanism on those moons. The odd thing is we're spending billions to go explore places like that and Mars, and what's the first thing we look for is water. We have a whole water planet right here that we've barely explored.
Yeah, exactly. And then obviously providing us with some remarkable models. One of the things I enjoy about Blue Frontier, even though it's overwhelming, is that you seem to be able to cover a lot of ground. Oftentimes, you read something about the ocean, and the author has either decided to, let's look at the species, or let's look at the, you know, the hydrology, how that works. But you manage somehow to cover, you know, the plight of the various species, like what the Navy was doing with dolphins, and then, you know, you move over to what's, you know, happening in terms of the wetlands and the, you know, the salt marshes and what have you, and then also getting into the, what's going on with current changes and all that. I think the reader comes out with a, maybe feeling a little overwhelmed, but with a lot more information than normal. Did you find it overwhelming as you were trying to kind of make those segues from one to the other? Or?
Well, no, actually, for me, it was, first of all, it was an excuse to, you know, spend a dedicated year visiting offshore oil rigs and landing on aircraft carriers and going down to underwater labs. I had a great time. I think what I saw is that in the true sense of ecology, which was a concept that started with Bill Ritter at Scripps Oceanographic back in the beginning of the last century, you begin to look at relationships and you see that you can't disconnect. And, you know, the holistic approach to the oceans is that, you know, all the living systems connect, and they connect back to our species, and the impacts we're having are political and social and conscious and unconscious. So, you know, I mean, for me, it was a resolution. I spent most of my career as a journalist, you know, going off to cover wars and epidemics and politics, and then going home to the beach where I was body surfing and diving. And when I finally got to write this ocean book, I just felt like, okay, now I'm going to concentrate on this 71% of the planet, leave the other 29% to the rest of you guys.
Well, it seems really appropriate right at this time in particular that, you know, you, for example, are looking at not only, excuse me, the impacts of current and past conflicts, but military planning and what the, you know, what the Bush administration and others are doing that's going to have an impact on the ocean, you know, designing different types of strategies in terms of, you know, designing more smaller vessels and what have you, or, you know, super carriers or whatever it may be.
The littoral warfare. I mean, the end of the Cold War took the Navy out of the deep blue ocean where they were chasing Soviet subs and brought them into what they call the littoral, the near shore environment, which is both scientifically and biologically more complex, and it's also where we've seen the loss of this is the productive base for the ocean ecosystem. And so you have this overlap where the Navy, for example, with its active sonars impacting marine mammals and fish, or potentially there could be some resolution. I mean, a lot of the technologies the Navy has, surveillance technologies, can also be used to track ecological processes, and a lot of people like Admiral Watkins talks about global ocean observation system. But the problem with that is really that it's not enough to do good science. The best available science is creating the worst imaginable scenarios, and there's this growing gap between the science, marine science and marine policy. You know, the technologies, ideally we take the best available science and we combine it with society's values and create policy. Right now, policy, like on shore, is being driven by special interest, by the offshore oil and gas guys, by the shipping industry, some commercial fishing, the coastal real estate developers, and the Navy. And it's like we need all these elements in some way, but we need them to work sustainably. And the only way that's going to happen is when the public understands it's their ocean, has that sense of entitlement,
right,
that they drive government and industry to do it the right way. The irony, like I pointed out in 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, is when we and society does the right thing for the oceans, it tends to also turn out to be good for ourselves, for our own health, for our own pocketbooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like we're forcing bad medicine down the people's throats. I just, before we leave that other point, to me it was that I was thinking back to like the first Gulf War and those images of the oil wells burning and the destruction to the marshes in the south where the marsh Arabs lived, and it was difficult at that time to get mainstream environmental groups to come out publicly and say, you know, this is a tragedy, both as a human rights tragedy and as an environmental tragedy. We should be, as environmentalists, concerned about what the military is doing here, and not just our own military, but obviously the Iraqi military as well. And that was not an easy sell.
Well, it's hard. I mean, I think increasingly with issues like energy, we're beginning to see that, you know, and I was off, it was interesting, one of the U.S. Ocean Commissioners, who was an oil guy, came up to me at one point and said he really liked the chapter in Blue Frontier I have on the oil industry, the offshore oil. And I'm thinking, like, what, the part where I call for the abolition of your industry? but you know, I knew what he meant. He meant that it was fun. I had good descriptions out there. I had a good time with the roughnecks and the roustabouts and this incredible technology they're using for deep ocean drilling. And, you know, I was out there, but I was feeling like I was on an 1850s whaling ship. You know, it was a part of our maritime history, but that time has come and gone. And we simply have to move on from fossil fuels. You know, 150 years ago, people would have said, you know, certainly the richest families in the nation in the 1850s were making their money in whale oil. They would have said that This is the lubricant of the machine age. It's lighting our finest streets. And are you crazy if we give up whale oil? You're also putting 10,000 whalers out of work in New Bedford and the Harpoon make. Well, we moved on to rock oil, and the economy expanded and things improved as a society. Now it's clear this product used as directed overheats our planet. We have to move on to new energy forms, and some of them we'll find in the ocean with tidal power, with offshore wind and OTEC, which is the thermal difference between deep and shallow water that they find can generate electricity and also bring nutrient-rich water up for sustainable aquaculture. Necessity drives innovation, and we're at a moment where you know, conservatives who are worried about funding terrorism through these oil-rich regimes, and environmentalists who are worried that we're going to have an environmental, quite literally, meltdown of the planet from the use of fossil fuels, can find common ground in looking for carbon-free alternatives. And unfortunately, that media lack of awareness or lack of presence isn't just in relationship to the environmental impacts of our wars. It's the environmental impacts of our policies in the Gulf, for example. I was down following Katrina, down in New Orleans and Plaquemine along the Mississippi coast. And at the time, a couple of weeks after the storm, I thought that when they finished counting the dead, they'd move on to report on the oil spills in the Gulf. The Coast Guard says there's over 9 million gallons spilled in tank farms and along the coast, and torn up pipelines and 116 rigs that were just damaged, severely damaged or completely destroyed.
9 million.
And it's two-thirds of an Exxon Valdez. And Congress right now is pushing hard to reopen offshore moratorium areas that have been protected for new drilling. And there's been very little coverage. I mean, there's a reporter at the Mobile Register who reported on the fact that in November, a barge, an oil barge, ran into a sunken oil rig that didn't have warning lights on it. And 1.5 to 3 million gallons of heavy oil sank to the bottom just in that one incident. And so it's disturbing how little coverage there has been of these cascading disasters, increased storms. There was just California, Hawaii have had record rains this winter. In Hawaii, it overflowed the sewage facilities and closed down Waikiki. And a guy got in a tussle, was pushed into the Awali Canal, got flesh-eating bacteria on him. He lost a leg within 24 hours. He was dead within 96. So all these petrochemical products, the fertilizer and nutrients, were feeding harmful algal blooms and diseases that come back not just to the fish but to us as well.
It's like a 1950s science fiction film. I mean, some of the things we're seeing happening. Do you... You still sound optimistic. Do you feel that we can pull these chestnuts out of the fire? I mean, do you think that some of these institutions aren't so embedded in, you know, between like the Defense Department and the government and the petroleum industry, they're so embedded that that we're not going to be able to kind of pry them loose so that we can...
I've seen enough solutions that I'm hopeful. I was just down in Key West on this book tour, and I first went down there to meet these folks, Reef Relief, this couple who started this campaign 10 years ago. And at the time, we were on their cabin cruisers up on the bridge. We were shooting down, videotaping this NOAA diver, National Oceanographic diver. He's wearing a dry suit and a hood, and he was gaffer taping around his wrists and gloves and his booties, going into the sewage outflow, sampling. When he came back on board, he was using a solution of betadine as he pulled his hood off. By the late 90s, the city folks in Key West saw that their reef that they depended on for their economy, their lifestyle, was dying. They invested, they didn't wait for the state or the feds. They invested a $25 million bond, tore up the old sewage pipes, created an advanced sewage treatment, nutrient stripping. They took other acts like getting rid of impermeable surfaces and putting in shell and gravel parking lots on the town front. And when I was down there a few weeks ago, I was snorkeling in this what used to be the sewage outfall is now Municipal Snorkel Park. Wow. And you see these gorgonians and soft corals coming back, and big tarpon and rays. I've seen shoals of small fish and parrotfish. You know, there's tremendous resiliency. We can turn it around. And the 50 Ways to Save the Ocean book is the idea, you know, people I talk to about these disaster, sometimes it's like, well, what can I do? I've already got a job and a family to raise. And I say, you're already doing something. You know, the choice, we're all doing something that impacts the ocean. The the thing is to be conscious of it and make the right choices. And, you know, and as I say, there's many examples. I spent most of my life in California, where there's Point Reyes National Seashore. 30 years ago, the plan was to put condominiums there, and they were going to put a nuclear power plant on Bodega Bay on the Bodega Head, and they were going to turn Route 1 into an 8-lane freeway, and the Army Corps of Engineers had a plan to take down San Bruno Mountain, fill in San Francisco Bay, and make it a wide spot in the Sacramento River. And all those changes started when three women there said no, form Save the Bay, turn the Army Corps plans around, and then, you know, people mobilized. It's the old quote from Margaret Mead. Says, if you question that a small group of people can change the world, nothing else really ever has.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel we get so much from the ocean in terms of recreation, transportation, trade, energy, protein, medicine. Just that sense of wonder that you know, I remember as a kid, you know, kids go to the beach and they look out at the oceans, that first sense that you're part of something larger than yourself. And it's both scary and very alluring. And we get so much out, I think people do want to give something back. It's how we do it. You know, as individuals, as consumers and citizens, it takes work. I mean, I was just 2 weeks ago, I was in New Jersey. The issue there is eminent domain. They're tearing down low and middle income beachfront communities and handing them over to private developers to put up these high rise condominium urban seawalls. The so-called public benefit is higher tax base. This teacher said every day she drives by those condos, she feels hopeless. I said, don't feel hopeless, feel outraged. You know, if you feel hopeless, they win, and the decline continues. If you feel outraged, there are, you know, 362 townships in New Jersey. The outraged citizens have to be at the zoning boards and taking on the developers and fighting for the estuaries and the waters that they grew up with and they love. And, you know, New Jersey, California, Oregon, I've met here with the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, and you have the marine protection group made up of fishermen and supporters out in at the end of the river here.
Mm-hmm.
You have so many, you know, people who've begun what we call seaweed rebellion, marine grassroots, and it's just getting back to basic citizenship. You know, politicians are like sharks; they're hardwired. You know, you can't really educate them; they're hardwired to stimuli. And if it's money and votes, and if we don't have the money of the shipping industry, we got votes and you know, places around our oceans that's around us. We can make change. It's just it's a scary moment, and you know, from a journalistic point of view, after updating Blue Frontier, I can't say, you know, the last chapter is still called the Seaweed Rebellion. I can't say we're going to mobilize people necessarily in time, educate the public in time to turn the tide. Or all I can really say is if we don't try, we lose.
We know, yeah, we know what the one answer is if we don't do anything at all. And clearly we need to try that out. And I think that's an important point you're raising as well, that, you know, not only does the environment, is the environment become a winner in that, but we create a richer democracy. I agree, it's so frustrating to go to these public hearings, and if you're lucky, you see one or two kind of blurry-eyed citizens who are trying to, you know, hold back the forces of, you know, of corporations who want to make a buck off of everything, and the politicians who, you know, just really don't care too much. They prefer things to move more smoothly. I mean, there's a certain irony here in Oregon that, you know, we have this wonderful Willamette River out here. There's a Superfund site right in the middle of the city. And they've been for years struggling and allowing the politicians to try to figure out a way to clean it up. And, I mean, we're fast approaching the point where citizens need to step in. But,
right. I mean, you've had the politics. You know, you take your salmon, which is sort of your, you know, Homeric, heroic, you know, fish that goes out to the ocean and back up your rivers. And it provides, you know, it's heroic. It's delicious. And it's a success story at one level. I mean, they're, you know, even with Oregon and California, with all the growth that's taken place here, there are millions of wild fish still coming back to the rivers. But this last year, there are 2 million wild fish, and you can't catch any of them because hidden among them are that handful of Klamath River salmon that are beat down because of a political decision. 3 years ago, Karl Rove told his people at the Department of Interior that the eastern Oregon irrigators were our base, And so they ignored the science that said if you take the water out of the river, the fish die. They ignored the economic studies. Mm-hmm. It says there's 30 times the value in recreation and fishing downriver than what the red state voters upriver might produce. And that political decision 3 years later is having tremendous consequences for, you know, the livelihood of both sport and recreational, commercial fishermen, tribal nations. So it's, you know, it's a good news, bad news. The good news is when people work collaboratively, we can, you know, there's a lot of resiliency left in the ocean. We can save a lot. The bad news is they're, you know, the politicians are going to, you know, they're going to migrate like after the dollars and after the political short-term interests and really ignore us pretty well until we make them. I mean, Sam Farr from politician who's a member of this, interestingly, last bipartisan group, the House Oceans Caucus, he says, you know, until you can get a situation where politicians fear that if they're not good on the coast and oceans, they might lose their job, until we reach that point, we're not going to have the ocean protection we deserve.
Well, I think that's a very good point, and it would certainly save us the absurdity of, in recent weeks here, we've had, in response to the low salmon turnout, you know, photo opportunities with politicians standing out near Bonneville Dam saying the problem is the sea lions who've come up river to eat on there. And, you know, having them actually standing by the dam, which is killing, you know, killing off, responsible for a lot of the drops in the salmon runs, and yet wanting to suggest that what we need to do is instead somehow put all the blame on another species.
Right, it's the pinnipeds, not us.
That's right, those are the guys. And if it's not them, there must be somebody else there. Well, now that you've done redone the Blue Frontier and this 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, what's next in the works?
Well, we're continuing to have conferences, what we call Blue Vision conferences, trying to bring activists together. We did a national one in Washington 2 years ago, 250 activists from Oregon and 20-some-odd other states. And, you know, building a solidarity and educating each other so we can be more effective movement. On the third day, we went up on Capitol Hill, met with 3 senators, a dozen Congress people and their staffs, and we followed up with a regional conference at the Baltimore Aquarium, activists between New York and North Carolina. We're going to do one this past fall in New Orleans, but got preempted by a hurricane. We may go back there. We're talking about the Pacific Northwest. There, as I say, there's so many effective groups working at the local level and the regional level and even the national level, but it's not a movement yet. It's got the potential to be a blue movement, and I think that that blue movement, with a lot of the people engaging with it, it's very interesting. Two of the Bush Ocean Commissioners, Admiral Jim Watkins, who used to run the Admiral Paul Gaffney, who was on the used to run the Office of Naval Research for the U.S. Navy, Lillian Barone, who used to run the Port of New York, they just wrote an editorial saying we need a seaweed revolution, saying they're frustrated. These are serious people. They spent 2 years. They issued a report, and they're seeing no reaction from the White House or the Hill. They've signed on. They said a recent speaker suggested this, and they're talking about how only citizen engagement will get us where we need to be. And it's, you know, it's very basic levels. I mean, the number one thing I have in 50 Ways to Save the Oceans, go to the beach.
Yep.
Pack out everything you pack in, you know, bring a litter bag, take away that plastic. But, you know, you got to enjoy it. You got to love it. Then you know what you're fighting for.
That's right. Then becomes a struggle from the heart. Well, again, thank you for sharing some time with us here at KBOO, and keep up the wonderful work. These are great books. I encourage folks to check them out, The Blue Frontier and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. Thank you, Dave.
It's a pleasure.
That was Dave Mazza speaking with environmental journalist David Helvarg about the state of the world's oceans. And we're going to go now to Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! Her guest today, James Yee, a Muslim chaplain who was posted in Guantanamo Bay in 2002 and later was accused of espionage, locked up in a Navy prison. Stay tuned for that. Thanks for tuning in to the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.